Welcome to the Immigrant Stories Program. I'm Walter Gallagher. And my interview today is with George Stranahan. George has been and done many things in his life. He's a photographer, a physicist, a teacher, an entrepreneur, a restaurateur, a rancher, a philanthropist, and a community organizer. George started looking for community and a sense of what he calls belongingness at an early age. I started by asking George how his family came to the United States.
And we believe that they went first from Ireland to Scotland, and then shortly thereafter, my grandfather's father landed in Boston and found a job. And I know nothing about my grandfather's. I was told my grandfather was night clerk at the Hotel Tremont in Boston. He had a job. And it was good enough that he could pay the tuition for his little brother to go to Harvard. He graduated from Harvard at 18, married, and with his child on his knee at graduation.
Wow.
Well,
there's the story.
That was an enterprise, and he was kind of the enterprise behind the family and the kind of guy who said, well, okay, night clerk? No, we're going to make a business. And they ended up with a spark plug business.
Well, and they started with bicycles.
Bicycles.
So tell.
There was a bicycle racer from France. His name was Alfred Champion. And they began having motorized bicycles. And the bicycle races turned out to be like motorcycle races, the early motorcycle. And that got them into the, well, you got to have a spark plug in a motorcycle. And, oh, we make a better one. We have a better motorcycle racer, et cetera, et cetera. And then they recognized around 1908 that cars were going to replace this sort of motorcycle thing, and that the car was it, and the car was going to have spark plugs. And right then, Toledo, Ohio, was the center of cars, not Detroit. And so they moved from bicycles to cars and from Buffalo to Toledo. And they actually stole a patent from France, but then they modified it a little bit, so they actually did make a better plug.
And then
and that got them into the market.
So how did they get the market? What did they do?
What they did is they went to Henry Ford and said, Henry, there's no reason for you to make, we make the better spark plug than you can make. We will sell it to you cheaper than you can make it. You would be a fool to make your own spark plugs. Buy from us forever. And Henry said, you're right. I make cars, you make spark plugs. And what they didn't realize was, in those days, spark plugs barely lasted 2,000 miles. Changing your spark plugs was like filling your gas tank. You did it often. And the money in spark plugs was replacement plugs, not original equipment. So we sold Henry the original equipment basically at no profit. And the replacement plugs were sold through gas stations, and we made a lot of profit.
Wow. So it sold it to Henry Ford for cost, and then...
Yeah. And then we made the money in the aftermarket. Now, eventually, as you may know your history, Ford eventually made their own plugs called Autolite. They finally caught on that, oh, making your own plugs is kind of, it's a good thing to do. So they went into competition. So my grandfather's brother was the aggressive entrepreneur. My grandfather was just a good guy, ran night clerk at the Hotel Tremont, put his brother through Harvard, etc. Good guy. My dad was an only son, and he grew up with a father who was, the fortune was building. I mean, it wasn't there, but it was building. And as only son, he felt that, of course I'd go into the family business. So he did. He was part of the family business.
When you came along, was it an interest for you to be part of that?
Well, eventually, so I was born in 1931. I'm a kid during the Depression. We hadn't really, we still lived on 2nd Street in Perrysburg in a little house. It wasn't there yet. It was growing. It was going to be there. By the time I got through college with a degree in physics, and my dad was very engineering, he would always talk about it. He would take me down to see the engineering department where they would run motors and test spark plugs and measure temperatures and temperature gradients, all, technical stuff about making a better plug. And I wrote the company a letter saying, I have these skills in mathematical physics. Perhaps I could be useful to this business, which has supported my family and me through college,
right.
And I'd be happy to do that. And I put a stamp on it and mailed it to Uncle Bob, who was president, and Uncle Bob didn't reply.
Really?
So I said, well, I guess you either don't want me or don't need me or whatever, but I'm gone.
So he never did, never was talked about. He
just No.
Just
didn't even get a no.
Really?
Yeah, that's okay.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher, and my interview today is with George Stranahan. George is talking about his early days growing up in Ohio.
So growing up for you in, again, from what I've read, when you were 12 and then you started realizing you wanted to be a scientist. And
yes. Yeah, I actually knew at age 12, I know what I want to be. And I know why I wanted that. It was.
How did you know?
It was, well, in those days we got Collier's, Look, Life, you know, there was weekly magazines were, and they were left out. We read them all. We looked at them all. And one of them was an advertisement for Bell Labs, and it was all this big, long, empty table with a solitary person thinking at it, and there were some beakers, flasks and stuff, little lab equipment. And I thought, that's what I want to do. I want to sit at a long, empty table all alone with some glassware and pour things back and forth. And that's what I want.
Huh. Were you a loner as a kid?
Yes, I was absolutely a loner. Yeah,
that's why that picture
spoke
to you.
That empty table really said, okay, this is how you want to be a loner.
Huh. So
glassware. Erlenmeyer flask.
And then you went off to boarding school, which you didn't like much, right?
I was sent to boarding school, and the school not of my choice, but none of it was my choice. I was 13 when I got taken down to the train station and put on the train and said goodbye.
Yeah, I've never really understood that.
That is cruel. I mean, I'm just, that was wrong.
Boarding schools, yeah, especially at that age. I mean, you're just coming into your sexuality and your...
You're barely even there. I mean, you know, that first maybe freshman year begins.
So you felt sort of abandoned. It wasn't like...
I felt pushed out and abandoned and put into a foreign world, you know, an Eastern prep school. They were all examples. A foreigner. From Ohio, you're a foreigner if you're in a Connecticut boarding school.
So they looked down their noses at you?
Yeah.
You were...
Oh, yeah. So then I was super lonely.
The immigrant experience within your own country, right?
Yeah, I was an immigrant.
Yeah.
Well, by that time, I had developed no social skills for, well, how do you be a friend? Well, you start a conversation. You ask questions about who are you, what are you, what do you like, you know, et cetera. You get to know somebody.
Right.
I did not have any of those skills.
Which is where, you know, usually at 13 is where you're starting to learn those
where
skills.
Where you should be learning.
Your family.
Well, so all I learned was how to be at that big empty table, how to be lonely. And I knew how to be lonely. Wow. So I was.
What did you fill that loneliness with?
I actually would kind of read and tinker and fuss, little solitary things.
You took an early interest in photography.
Yeah, I had my mom's Leica, and I enjoyed, that was something to do. I did that, and then I found two compadres. You know, by then, World War II was beginning, and there was surplus gear. You could buy a surplus tank radio for $3.50 plus shipping. I mean, a full two-way transmitter receiver full of tubes and gear.
Gadgets.
And I found two guys who liked to take apart and reassemble the gadgets, and I joined it. Then I really was happy. And we built a thriving little business. Phonographs were forbidden in the Hotchkiss School, or radios. That would be distracting from your work, so they were not allowed. Well, needless to say, once we were taking these tank radios apart, we were making receivers that we could receive radio signals. And but we had these terrazzo floors in the dorms, and there's a little brass strip that goes down to for the thermal expansion of the transit floor. But that's a conductor. And the other conductor in every room was the radiator, which is basically grounded. So we would put our radio signal out under the little brass thing in the transit floor, and we would get monthly payments from people with their earphones. who could stick a wire out to the trestle floor and another wire to the radiator and listen to music, for goodness sakes. Of course, that's a punishable crime. I mean, you're not allowed to listen to the radio in the Hotchkiss school. And here these people are doing it. And who are the criminals that are enabling? And, well, it was us.
The usual suspects? Or did you already have a reputation in there? Or did they know where to go?
At this point, we were also... Hotchkiss school is quite isolated, but we would take a hike and buy cigarettes for all, so illegal, of course, as was alcohol and music. So we'd take a hike down to the cigarette machine, and we had cigarettes available for purchase by those who wanted to do so. We had music for those who had earphones, rent the earphone. We also got into distilling aftershave lotion into a potable product.
The entertainment division of the Hotchkiss School.
And this actually became, you know, I had friends, I had something to do that I liked, et cetera, et cetera. And finally the school caught on that something's going on. I mean, kids are showing up drunk in English class. And there's criminal activity going on here.
Oh, my God.
And the administration said, this is so serious that we can't do it as faculty. We have to turn it over to the student council. They have to, you know, they should be able to, they must deal with it.
Democracy in action, yeah.
Yeah, we would just look like autocrats if we did it. So I remember waiting in line, going down, being called in front of the student council to testify, and there were these 12 council members, and I started from the left, customer, customer, cigarettes, yes, booze, music. All 12 were customers. We skated.
That's a great story. So, no, the parents never heard about it?
My parents got a letter saying, you know, we think that your son was involved in some stuff that could be shady, but we're not going to throw him out. I graduated.
What was your parents' reaction? Did they?
They said, we got this strange letter. And I said, yeah. And that was the end of the conversation. Now, I was able... That sort of piece of me that says, you tell me to jump, I'm going to say how high, because I'm not jumping any higher than you know. Uh-huh. You tell me how high, and I'm not giving you a half an inch more, because I don't like being told to jump.
Right.
So at the Hotchkiss School, they scored on 0 to 100, 60 was passing. And you could keep a four-year record of my grade point average. I graduated 61. They told me how high to jump, and I... jumped that high.
So you really didn't like it. You just...
I hated it.
What was it? What was it that was so...
I wanted to learn science, and they really didn't have science. We had Greek literature. You had to pass a year of Latin, which took me 2 years to do.
I had the same problem.
And, that's not what I wanted.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher, and my interview today is with George Stranahan. George is talking about the sense of loneliness that he had as a child and his quest for community and belongingness.
I graduated 124th out of 126. So once again, I jumped as high. However, I was the only undergraduate who had already published a scientific paper in Astrophysical Journal by the time I graduated. Okay.
Yeah, there
we go.
I bet they didn't know how to sort of manage you, or you know, you were.
No, they didn't.
You were a rebel of a different.
Once again, I didn't fit. I didn't know how to fit, and so I just kind of did it my way. And
where did that come from? I mean, you were.
If you're lonely enough, you become you are your only friend, and you build yourself to be your friend.
But who helped with that?
You. Nobody.
Nobody.
You got a lot of time with yourself when you're lonely.
Well, what about your folks? How?
No.
They were off too busy or doing other things?
They believed in being busy. And they thought that by being busy, they were teaching me everything they needed to, which is...
Watch us be busy and grow.
Yeah. You know, part of this sort of middle class, getting to be upper middle class, suburban, industrial Toledo class of... people who were making it, you know, they had, some had a cook, some had a maid, many had a nursemaid for the children. Because I didn't know how to do it, I was quite repelled by the process. Guess what a nursemaid will never tell you? I love you. because she's not going to love you, because she might be fired tomorrow. She does not want to love that child. The pain of, no.
It's a job.
And she doesn't. It's a job. So I was her job, not her loved one. And I really was angry about all of that.
Yeah.
And I really rejected all that kind of privilege and stuff.
But you basically wanted to belong, to be loved and be part of a family. And
yeah, I know. But guess what? I mean, the help is not going to give you that.
Exactly.
You
really have to, you know. So you were on a quest.
Yeah, and I didn't know how to do it in school or elsewhere.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories program. I'm Walter Gallagher, and my guest today is George Stranahan, Valley Icon. George finally fell in love and got married, and he tried to give his wife and kids the love and attention he never had. He started graduate school at Carnegie Institute of Technology, but career and family life was interrupted by the Korean War. After serving his 2 years, George returned to graduate school. But the heat of the East Coast summers drove him west to a favorite childhood memory.
My parents were skiers, as very few people were in 1940. And in 1949, they were reading some magazine, said, there's a new ski area out in Colorado, it's called Aspen. And he said, well, let's go. And it was my school vacation time at the Hotchkiss School, and I went with him. And I skied, and I thought, this is heaven. It's Aspen, the mountain, the hills, skiing.
It was a ghost town at that point.
Yes, absolutely a ghost town. It was the first year. The others left 1A, period. But I thought it was wonderful. And I said, you know, somehow or other, I'm going to end up here.
Did you know how to ski and had learned that
back
east?
Yeah, I knew enough. And you know.
Right.
You would ski from top to bottom of Ajax, maybe see two skiers.
Yeah, seeing Aspen for the first time probably is life-changing. I'm afraid
it was life-changing.
It is for a lot of people.
You know, I love some of the mountains grab me. Some people like oceans, some people like mountains.
If you like mountains, that's you drop into that space, yeah. And it's amazing.
So when I was in graduate school, I'm going back to graduate school. I'm a theoretical physicist. Okay, I do pencil on paper. I don't have electronics. I don't have cryogenics. I don't have any equipment. My physics is in my head.
Philosopher, scientist.
Yeah. So I'm out of the Army. I'm back at graduate school. It's Pittsburgh. And I look at my family, which is now getting to be four kids, maybe a fifth on the way, and say, we don't have to stay in Pittsburgh for the summer. We have to be here for the winter because I go to classes. But why don't we go out to Aspen for the summer? This was now 1956, I think. And the family said, well, Aspen, what? Well, why not? It's hot in Pittsburgh. Let's go. So for $400, I rented a four-bedroom house in Aspen, out in Cemetery Lane, and the Jeep was thrown in extra for free. And family of six with their own Jeep, $400 for the whole summer. And it was incredible. It was wonderful. The kids loved it, the sunshine. I was hiking and fishing. And pretty soon I realized, well, you're hiking, you're not doing physics, you're faking the physics. You know, you brought the notebook and the pencil, but you're hiking and fishing. Mm-hmm. And the wife loved it, the kids were happy, life was easy. Charge account at Beck and Bishop.
Well, and Aspen was a grand experiment at that point, wasn't it?
It was an early experiment, yeah.
You came and said, hey, why not, let's put a center for physics here.
Well, what happened was pretty soon I realized you're not doing physics when you're out here in Aspen, and you want to be in Aspen. So what you need to do, what I understood was, doing physics is not a solitary thing. It's not just you and the pencil and the paper. It's you and a person talking. It's a relationship about words and language and math and putting it up on a blackboard and say, what do you think?
It's not the kid. It's not the person at the end of the
table. You can't do it all alone.
Yeah, you have to. It's interactive.
So I told myself, well, if you want to be in Aspen in the summers, you're going to have physicists here. It was arranged for me to have a meeting with Bob Craig, who was then a new young executive director at the Aspen Institute. And as the new young golden guy, and Walter Pepke had cancer, was dying. So Walter was fading out. Robert was new and he had power and glory. And I had dinner with Robert. And I said, you need a physics center out here. You need not just to be where business and academia come together. You need to be a place where academia happens. And he said, you're right. We should have that. I said, yeah, I can build you a physics center. We need one here. He said, but you have to give me the land. Well, he did. He bought it.
He did, huh?
He said, yes, I want a physics center. He said, you can do it? I said, yeah, I can do it. So we did it.
What was it? And that's sort of a gentleman's agreement. I mean, he trusted you and you trusted him.
Yeah.
It was...
We got along for whatever reason. We trusted each other. Now, that was amazing. He got the Institute to give... We were the physics division of the Aspen Institute for Humanistic Studies. They were our fiscal agents, so we get a government grant. We got a government grant. We got scientists to come. We got the money to build the building. We pulled it together.
Yeah.
1962, we opened.
It's an amazing time.
Yeah, amazing. And now I had a place, I had the kids, I had a real business. I had something to do.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher, and my guest today is Valley icon George Stranahan. After graduate school, George taught physics at Michigan State University and spent his summers at the Center for Physics in Aspen. So when his marriage fell apart in 1972, he knew exactly where he wanted to go to start over.
When I leave Michigan with the kids and leaving the wife separated and I move out, there is a Center for Physics. This is down 1972 and I move... leave the university permanently. But I have a landing place. I have an Aspen Center for Physics. So I said, okay, I will make my new life here as...
What was your interest in it? Did you have
my
ownership?
Interest, no.
No, you were just...
We were guests on the Institute land.
Uh-huh.
We were the physics division. I was the executive director. I made sure we had a grant, we had participants, we wrote papers, we did work, blah, blah, blah. And my interest really was... how do you build a scientific community? It's not a community of scientists. It's a scientific community. It's a community that works together, cares together, shares together. That's different than just doing physics, is that we are doing it together. We have this commonality that we celebrate. So I was kind of focusing on how do we take this little building and these people who come here to do their physics and get them to really talk to each other, to know each other, to collaborate. And that's what I learned how to do.
Well, it sounds like you were pulling on elements that you had been missing in your life as a young person.
I guess there was something like that.
Yeah,
about,
you were building a family of physics.
Yeah, it's late
physicists.
In life. I'm going to learn how people make friends. So we did, this is the way I thought. I said, well, when do you learn to talk to somebody? Well, when you're waiting in line for the urinal. Of course, you whoever's standing for, hi, who are you from Indiana? Oh, yeah. You begin to talk. So we only had one urinal for all of the offices, so that you had to stand in line, so that you had to say to whoever you were waiting with, begin a conversation.
That was a design, huh?
That was my design.
You designed that.
And we did the same thing with the telephone and the library, and you were not allowed to have a phone on your desk. You had to go down to the phone in the back room and stand in line. And I didn't want you phoning. I wanted you talking to somebody next to you. And we got lots of things. We still are the largest bicycle rental firm in Aspen.
Really? But,
well, you drive out here with your family to spend 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks at the Center for Physics. You leave the car with a wife and a family. They go do something all day. And you bicycle to the Physics Center. Well, if you're going to do that, then you're going to brown bag. And then we got the culture, okay, we'll have a volleyball court back behind here where we brown bag. So we'll brown bag our lunch and we'll play a little volleyball together. And, you know, you can say, nice shot. Oh, your name's Eric. Yeah. Nice shot, Eric. I began to do that.
Building community.
And it really was something that we did and with success. And eventually our funding became the National Science Foundation. He said, you know, what we see happening is people come to the Center for Physics, they start new collaborations. They build new relationships, new collaborations and partnerships that are taking them into new fields. And he said, this is what we want to fund. So we became the golden boy for money.
Well, you're an interesting mix of a humanist and a scientist and a sociologist.
Well, lonely kid grows up.
Lonely kid grows up. But you came to it late, but you knew you had the skills to
I had some intuitions about, you know, if I had it to do again, I might.
Did you ever think you were going to be a community organizer?
No. But looking back, I was.
You were?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
And looking back, I stopped doing physics because I was busy trying to say, how do we make these people function as, you know, together we are more than we are separate, always.
Huh.
And so it was together as scientists, we can do more than separate.
And that's carried you through through your
through
life.
Through the community school,
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was George Stranahan, and as you can probably tell, George was just getting started. If you'd like to hear more about George's life in Woody Creek and Hunter S. Thompson, the birth of the Woody Creek Tavern, and the Valley Settlement Project, you can go to kdnk.org, and there click on About at the top of the page and scroll down to Programs. It's there you'll find Immigrant Stories and part 2 of George's story. Thanks for listening.